Welcome to the latest episode of the Custom Private Equity Podcast, Private Equity in the 2010s. Today, we'll talk with Paul Anthony Thomas, the principal at CustomPrivateEquity.com. I'm Ron Davis, experienced podcaster, and I'll be asking all the newbie questions. Good afternoon, Paul.
Hey, Ron, how are you today?
I am good. And so we're continuing our series, and this will be sort of the last one in this series because we're going to come up to the present day. We're going to do the last decade between 2010 and 2020. Can you remind us again what you consider to be private equity investment?
Well, private equity investment, Ron, is when a private individual or a private pool of money, fund, family, group of families gets together and they pool money together and they put it into a private investment, not the public stock markets. Not a public stock, not a public bond, but a private investment. And sometimes it can be for expansion capital. A lot of times it's for venture capital. A lot of times it's a buyout type situation where they go in and buy a company and buy all the rights or just half the rights to a product line. So there's a thousand different ways to schedule a private equity investment and to design it where it can fit into somebody's portfolio. And it really all depends on the management of the firm and the management of the company that you're buying into or the management of the company you're starting. So that's what we consider to be private equity.
Okay. And so what was the economy and inflation doing in the 2010s?
Well, the decade of the 2010s saw a major disconnect between the government reporting on the economy and what we consider to be the true economy. So by the end of the decade, unemployment was nationally low. By this is 2018-19, unemployment was about 3.5%. But the crisis of 2008 had driven literally millions of people into the disability rolls. So the budget of the federal government grew in a huge relation to what it had been in the past. So if you ask the government, is the economy doing well? The answer was yes, and unemployment's low and a lot of people have jobs. But half the number of people were looking for jobs that were looking for jobs in 2007 before the crisis. The ranks of the citizens on disability grew by 300% during this period of time, during the early 2010s. And the government inflation rate was calculated about 2 to 2.5% throughout the time, throughout the 10 years of the decade. But the government continually raised their debt ceiling. They continually issued more money. And we consider that inflation rate, the real true inflation rate, was somewhere between 7.5% and 15%. So this is something that investors really have a hard time getting their minds around, is the true inflation rate versus what the government's telling them the inflation rate is. And this is something that we spend a lot of time working on. And this is one reason we deal in hard assets that provide cash flow for our investors.
And so what were the big stories of the 2010s?
Well, one of the biggest stories was the IPO of Facebook. They raised $16 billion in May of 2012. The interesting thing about that IPO, by the end of the year, by December, that IPO was worth $16 a share, where it had come out in the public markets at $38 a share. So it was worth half as much. Schwab, one of the biggest things that happened early in the decade was Charles Schwab cut his commission rates from $13 a trade to $9 a trade, starting a war that has today ended in zero commissions for stock trades. And that's all been made possible by personal computers in the computer age. The social media world tripled. Facebook came out, Google came out, Amazon and Apple and those big companies, the government started looking at them as monopolies and trying to talk about breaking them up, which they're still doing in the 2020s. Bitcoin was created in 2008, and by December of 2017 was trading at $19,000 a coin. That's a very interesting model, but we still consider that to be an extremely risky and volatile investment. One of the big things that happened in the private equity markets and in the public stock market as well is that companies started issuing dual class shares, where they would issue an A share and a B share. And the A shares were the higher priced shares, and they would have all the voting rights and voting power in the corporate structure. And the common shareholder holding the B class shares would have virtually no power to vote. This was the decade was considered to be the decade of private equity. In 2008, 9, and 10, there were like 3,000 private equity firms from all sizes, from the Blackstones of the world down to people like me who run just multi-million dollar funds. Interest rates were so low after the financial crisis of 2008, the government was funneling so much money into the economy that you could borrow money for virtually nothing and put it to work in an investment fund and make the spread between them. Fees went down among the larger private equity managers from 2% to 1.5%, and some of the largest fund managers only charged 1% fees. A study came out late in the decade, 2015-16, that even with smaller fees that the mega funds were charging, an investor would do better investing with a small fund manager versus the Blackstone of the world. So private credit became such a big deal, it became its own asset class. And then today is a huge asset class. Private banks became more prevalent because private investors wanted collateral for their investments instead of just handing over the money.
So what is the difference between a private bank and a non-private bank?
So a private bank is not regulated. A private bank can make any deal. As long as they don't charge interest rates that are what considered to be usurious, they can make any deal with anybody they want to. They're not regulated by the Banking Commission. They're not regulated by the SEC. They're not regulated by anybody. That's the difference between that and a public bank, which is like your First National Bank or First Financial Bank or Chase Bank or Wells Fargo. Those are public banks and they're not private. So they are required to do certain things and they are audited by certain people and required to do audits. Private banks are not required to do any of those things.
And so do you have to be a certain kind of person to borrow from a private bank?
Yes. Federal Express would have its own private banking relationships with somebody from Goldman Sachs. So an example of a private bank, Beal Bank, is a big private bank, and they only deal with commercial clients. So they only deal with the HEBs of the world, you know, the big corporations. They don't deal with, they won't even let a small family, a $10 million family in their business. They just don't take those kind of deposits.
So. Okay. And so how did all of these big money, private banks, private credit, and all these, you know, Amazons and Facebook IPOs, how did all of that affect the hourly worker?
Well, basically during this decade, the hourly worker lost out in pretty much in a big way because the government was lowering the value of the dollar by creating so many new dollars, and they put $4 trillion in the banking system between 2008 and 2012. And we've actually in 2020 done that again. But the value of the dollar went down by 20%, but the minimum wage did not go up by 20%. So all the working poor people got poorer than they were because they couldn't, their dollars wouldn't buy as much. That's why we say inflation was somewhere between 7.5% and 15%, because prices for everyday goods went up when a lot of fuel prices and things came down. But so those two things offset themselves in the government numbers. But in the real world numbers, you know, the price of a loaf of bread didn't go down. It went from 49 cents to $1.49. The Great Recession of 2008, there are a lot of people in today's world, even in 2020, 12 years later, that have never recovered from that disaster that happened to them. Their wealth, their jobs are gone. Their living standards are half what they were, especially someone that was late in their life and 55 to 60 years old and they were counting on retirement. The stock market lost 50% of its value and they haven't ever been able to recover if they had to take their dollars out at that time. The government spent trillions of dollars on programs in the late 2010s. Much of the money has found its way into the stock market too, which is, makes the stock market looks really great today, but it's because the government's funneling money into the economy and that money's finding its way into the stock market.
And what did interest rates and the stock market do in the 2010s?
Well, the Dow started at 10,000 in 2010, and by 2019, it's close to 28,000. The Federal Reserve took interest rates down to below 0.5%, so money was cheap to borrow, and wealthy people could borrow money at low rates and put it in investments.
What did the world of private equity do in the 2010s?
Well, the 2010s are called the private equity decade, and private equity basically came to its fruition and came to its pinnacle during the 2010s with people raising billion-dollar funds almost on a monthly basis. In 2019, at the end of the decade, there was reported $1.5 trillion in what they call dry powder, which is money sitting in the bank managed by a private equity firm or a corporation that is looking for a place to be invested. Versus in 2009, 10 years earlier, there was only about $750 billion. So there's twice as much money at the end of the decade sitting in the bank waiting to be invested by a private equity firm as there was in the first part of the decade. To enhance their bottom lines and their internal rates of return, or IRRs, large funds started using their written commitments as collateral at the bank, at the private banks, to borrow money, and they were called sublines. So all this types of thing is called financial engineering. And these financial engineering type, derivative type transactions fool investors into thinking that a private equity firm is doing much better than they are. So they take the volatility out of those investment platforms and they engineer them to where their internal rates of return are 14%. Well, if you can borrow money at 4% and you can invest money at a fake 14%, that 10% spread is a lot of money if you're investing $1 billion at a time. So this is an example of financial engineering. And the sublines have created that for the private equity firms, and that's what the BlackRocks of the world use. We view it as a private equity firm, small private equity firm. We view that as a very risky strategy. It's a very derivative strategy, which increases credit risk. If the economy turns south and stays south, those people are going to be in trouble because Wells Fargo at that point is not going to honor their commitment to the private equity bank, which in turn is collateral to Chase Bank, which is the financial engineering. The whole house of cards is going to come down. We don't use those types of strategies in our practice at all. Towards the end of the decade, the private equity world has turned to what they call impact investing, where what you see in this world is that the responsible companies that have been good investments all along remain good investments because they have been environmentally responsible. They have been good stewards of their investors' money. They have been socially responsible all throughout their history. Federal Express is an example of that. They're a great company. They put lots of money back into their environment, back into their people. They put a lot of money into their where they work. You do find companies out there that are not very good stewards. And generally speaking, they haven't really performed all that well as the general rule without the risk involved in that.
And what were some of the memorable P&E stories of 2010?
The 2010s was a decade of mergers and acquisitions. Activist investors came to the forefront. CEO paychecks went through the roof. Those are three things that actually were very poignant issues in the private equity world. Late in the decade, there was over $1.5, maybe $2 trillion of dry powder waiting to be invested. During the decade, Toys R Us went bankrupt. That was a very interesting private equity, private debt program. Companies like Sports Authority and Gymboree went bankrupt, Linens and Things, many others. In 2017, the Limited closed 250 stores, throwing its employees out of work. The private equity firm that owned it during that time when it was going bankrupt, a company called Sun Capital, reported to its investors that it nearly doubled its money on that investment, thanks to dividends and fees that it paid itself during that investment period. So that's a typical type of a large private equity deal where the private equity firm charges a whole lot of fees to make the investment and structure the debt. And then the company goes bankrupt, but the private equity firm gets to keep their money. We don't do any of those types of things in our practice. According to PitchBook platform, in 2009, there were 1,900 deals completed, private equity deals, worth about $140 billion. In 2018, there were 5,100 private equity deals, virtually 2.5 times more. And that was worth over about $700 billion. So the private equity world grew immensely during this period of time. One of the reasons the private equity business grew and the private debt business grew is because banks couldn't loan the way they used to. after the financial crisis of 2008, banks were more restricted on the way they were able to loan money and the credit risk they were able to take with people. As we discussed in our last episode, the tactics that led to the 2008 crisis are being basically repeated again. They're repeated and repeated over and over again. In 2008, the syndication of mortgage-backed securities, which started in the mid-1990s, came to a head as the people on Wall Street started digging down into the lower credit mortgages and syndicating those mortgages and putting them into funds and not telling the investor who was buying the mortgage-backed securities. But all those things that I've just discussed are called financial engineering. Those financial engineering strategies are what gets Wall Street and what we call the greedy people on Wall Street, gets them in trouble because they don't look at the risk involved. They just look at the amount of fees they can make. As an investor, you must guard against these types of things, and you got to prevent it from happening in your portfolio. And the only way to do that is to get with a good manager who doesn't use these financial engineering tactics.
So, Paul, how do you guard your portfolio from these financial engineering products?
Basically, you find a manager who uses common sense in his management. He uses hard work. He does his research. He looks at all angles of a deal before he actually puts money in the deal. You invest in strong businesses that are not fly-by-night ideas. You invest in cash flow type businesses that are going to create wealth for the investor, for yourself. We do it by conducting deep research into hard assets, real estate, energy, oil and gas, solar. We do some venture. If we come up, we find somebody that's got a really great idea or got a lot of experience and they know what they're doing, we'll back them. We stay with basic needs like food and water and energy, certain types of real estate. The computer world is a great place in today's world. The internet, as long as you're not investing in a company basically that's losing money, you're going to be okay. Something with a sustainable revenue stream. In our part of the venture world, we will provide a round B or a round C financing where they've already proven their strategy, and we'll help them grow. Today, we consider our investment model to be steeped in deep research and knowledge of our markets. We consider it to be an extremely advanced type of investing.
Now, your firm is called, and this podcast is called, Custom Private Equity. How do you customize investment for your partners?
Well, basically, the first thing we do is we get to know our partners, and we get them to tell us what they like, and we look at their portfolio, and we work with them to decide what they want to invest in. And then we'll go out and we'll do the research and we will put together a platform for them. If they need commercial real estate, to say if they're in this, everything they own is in some kind of technology, we'll reallocate some of their money into a portfolio that's more balanced and will actually support them better when the market turns down. So another way that we can customize an investment is if an investor needs cash flow and they're during their retirement years, we can invest some of their capital into a cash flowing instrument. So we can invest into a series of 10 self-storages that cash flow in good times and bad. We can invest in a 20,000 barrel a day oil and gas portfolio that throws off cash every day. We can invest in solar farms that throw off revenues every day, things like that. We can invest in utilities and create utilities, water utilities, cable systems, things that are very, what we consider to be very secure and very safe investments for people.
And what types of platforms and research were you doing during the 2010s?
Well, as discussed in my last episodes, a couple of episodes, we began syndicating investments in the 1980s, 1970s and 1980s. And we continue to syndicate investments today as we do research into markets and find niche markets that we want to pursue and participate in. We will syndicate an investment platform and investors can buy into those platforms. An example of that is we monitored and did research into the Houston Medical Center complex, where we could have bought any piece of ground in the complex for $20 a foot in 2007. And today, those properties sell anywhere from $125 to $150 a foot. That's the type of growth we look for. Those are the types of investments we try to get into. We continue to monitor markets and do research into markets all over the Gulf Coast, all over Texas. In the energy market, we do research all over North America. We monitor the real estate in Texas. We like Texas. One of the fastest growing areas of Texas that we like today is called Trinity Grove, which is located 1 mile west of the Central Business District of Dallas. We also monitor real estate in Plano and McKinney, Fort Worth, up and down the I-35 and I-45 corridors. We like growth areas. Plano is an example of that. In the early part of the 2000s, we put together a portfolio in 2007. We had an investor invest about $30 million with us, with our team, and we put together a portfolio of 40 self-storages for him. And in 2013, he sold those self-storages out and walked away with about $200 million net profit in cash on that deal. That equates to about a 30% IRR. Those deals are hard to come by in today's world. Today, we target about 20 to 22% internal rates of return for our investors. Sometimes we do that. Sometimes we don't do that.
And what did you do in the energy space?
Well, we put together an energy fund, and that energy fund has done extremely well. In 2008, when everybody was losing their shirt, that energy fund threw off a 17% cash dividend back to our investors. That was an excellent year for us. In recent years, it hasn't done as well as it did in early years, but we still own our properties. We pay cash. We don't have any debt. So we're sitting pretty in that. We occasionally run across a billion-dollar deal in the oil and gas business that we want to try to buy. We would love to raise some capital and build some solar farms. They're building huge billion-dollar solar farms in West Texas without the government subsidies. As long as the government subsidizes those, they're going to be investments that we would have interest in. Because when the government stops subsidizing those farms, then they're not going to be financially viable anymore.
And what other types of hard asset plays were you researching?
Well, we continually research the equipment leasing marketplace. We manage a small leasing firm. We continue to try to expand that. We've done a lot of research into Texas groundwater, very extremely profitable. We continue to research day surgery centers and mobile CT scanners and MRI machines. Lake Charles, Louisiana is actually one of the best markets in the United States today. It's all about, in the real estate world, it's all about the market and what the market's doing. And we watch these markets continually. The COVID epidemic that's happened in 2020 has set the economy back, and it's made some tremendous opportunities in the energy space, both in solar and in oil and gas. As of December of 2020, we felt like in the last 90 days that we could have invested probably $2 million in oil and gas related equipment, with the projection that we would turn that into about a $4 million pool of capital over the next 24 months. So those are the types of growth industries and growth opportunities we look for.
All right. Well, thank you for your time today, Paul. If you want more information about today's topic, go to customprivateequity.com. There are a number of resources there, as well as multiple ways to contact Paul. Once again, that URL is customprivateequity.com. Any final words, Paul?
Yes, Ron, I appreciate you being here today, and I thank you for your time. I wanted to tell the final words in this series of podcasts is that if you're really going to invest in the private equity world, you need to get in partnership with an asset manager that is curious and has a vision for the future, has some decades of experience in the business, can see the big picture, someone that focuses on the positives of cash flow and hard assets and that want to grow your asset base and prevent you from losing money. That's our mantra for our practice. And our whole goal is to keep you ahead of inflation and keep your wealth growing. Thank you.